Hej, det er din vært, Anders Nedergaard, a.k.a. Dr. Muskel. Du skal til at lytte til et afsnit af Fitness MK, og det er jeg naturligvis rigtig glad for, at du gerne vil bruge din tid på. Men før du giver dig i kast med det, så har jeg lige en lille smule public service announcements, som jeg gerne vil stange ud. Hvis du allerede har hørt dem før, eller er pisse ligeglad, så kan du springe et par minutter frem, og så slipper du for det. Men noget af det handler om, at vi er begyndt at genudgive de gamle afsnit af Fitness MK for Radio 24/7-tiden. Det har du formentlig lagt mærke til, hvis du følger podcasten. Det er jo sådan, at de første 222 afsnit af Fitness MK blev lavet på Radio 24/7, hvor det både blev udgivet som radioprogram og podcast. Og det var i årrækken fra 2015 til 2020. Og det betyder jo, at det er nogle afsnit af en ældre dato, og da mange af afsnittene grundlæggende har en videnskabeligt sådan fundament, så er det værd at bemærke, at videnskaben kan ændre sig i den mellemliggende periode, ligesom at verdens og gæsternes holdning til nogle af de ting, der bliver diskuteret, også godt kan have ændret sig. Man kan genkende de gamle afsnit på deres programnummer, så hvis man går ind i den app, man afspiller det fra, og ser, at tallet det er 220 eller lavere, så er det selvfølgelig, fordi det er de gamle afsnit. De har også en lidt anden produktion med nogle andre jingler, og alle afsnit fra det 427, de har også en længde på 54,5 minut, hvor de fleste af afsnittene produceret efter, de er længere. Vi gør det sådan, at vi genudgiver et af de gamle afsnit hver tirsdag og torsdag, mens at eventuelle nyproducerede afsnit de bliver udgivet som vanligt lørdag morgen. Og vi gør det, at når vi udgiver de gamle afsnit, så får de lov til at ligge øverst i feedet. Vi giver dem altså en ny udgivelsesdato, sådan så de kommer til at ligge øverst for alle dem, der sorterer dem efter udgivelsesdato. Men når de har ligget øverst i feedet i cirka en måned, så retter vi deres udgivelsesdato til deres oprindelige udgivelsesdato, så de rykker ned i feedet, hvis man sorterer efter dato. Sådan så de kommer til at ligge i den rigtige rækkefølge efter en måneds tid, både numerisk og kronologisk. Jeg skal også sige, at den kontaktmail, jeg giver i podcastene, både de gamle og de nye, den har jeg ændret på, eller den er ikke længere den, som jeg siger i afsnittet, den er nu fitnessmk@andersnedergaard.dk, og ikke den, som der bliver angivet i afsnittet. Jeg har også lavet et nyhedsbrev til podcasten, og jeg har lavet om på hjemmesiden også, for at gøre brugeroplevelsen af podcasten lidt bedre. Der er en blog med et kommentar til nogle af afsnittene og nyheder om den, og der er indlæg oprettet til hvert podcast-afsnit hvor, med programteksten og links til de forskellige afspillertjenester og lidt andre ting, hvis man har lyst til at følge med i podcasten. Der er selvfølgelig også et sted, hvor man kan signe op til nyhedsbrevet. Nyhedsbrevet, der får man månedligt at vide noget om, hvad der er sket og hvad der kommer til at ske i podcasten, og en gang imellem så vil jeg også udsende lidt bonusmateriale via dem. Der er links til alle de her forskellige ting i programteksten i den app, du hører podcasten fra. Og nu skal jeg ikke spille mere af din tid. Jeg vil ønske dig et rigtig godt afsnit og en god dag. Vi snakkes ved. Du lytter til Fitness MK. Det er programmet for os, der træner. I dag der skal vi snakke om sten. Lidt mere specifikt det her med at løfte sten. Og både som verbum og som substantiv, fordi det handler både om løftesten og at løftesten. Og til det formål, der har vi fået lov til at ringe op til en irer, der hedder David Keehan, der beskæftiger sig med lige præcis det. Så det er det, vi skal snakke om i dag. Så i Fitness MK snakker vi jo om mange ting, der har relation til styrke på forskellige måder, både sportsvidenskab og styrke, kultur og stærkmandssport og sådan noget. Og det her, det er noget, der berører alle par alle sammen. Det glæder mig rigtig meget til at komme i gang med. Interviewet er optaget på en tjeneste, der hedder Zencaster, hvor man har optaget ligesom hver sin ende samtidig. Det her, det er, jeg har så lavet den her dansksprogede intro og outro, og der er lige en enkelt lille blyp undervejs også, hvor vi har nogle tekniske problemer, hvor der kommer lidt herfra igen. Men det er sådan, som dagens program, det kommer til at forløbe. Hvis du kunne tænke dig, og hvis du vil have sådan bedre forudsætninger for at forstå det, vi snakker om i dagens podcast, så kan jeg henvise til nogle tre dokumentarfilm, som træningsudstyrsproducenten Roke har lavet, som hedder henholdsvis Levantadores, som handler om stenløfterkultur i Baskerlandet, og Fullstærkur, der handler om de islandske løftesten, og Stoneland, der handler om de skotske løftesten. De er utroligt smukke. Jeg kan virkelig anbefale at se dem. Meget velproduceret.
Og det vil gøre mange af tingene, vi skal snakke om, mere om, jeg ved ikke, om det er ikke så svært at forstå det, vi snakker om, men det gør det for måske mere relaterbart. Man kan også godt se dem bagefter, så tror jeg, det virker sikkert også fint. Så ja, det er jo egentlig bare det. Jeg er svært Anders Nedergaard, a.k.a. Dr. Muskel. Og dagens gæst hedder David Keehan fra Irland. Og I skal velkommen til at skrive ind til programmet som altid. Det gør man på afn@andersnedergaard.dk. Eller også at skrive mig til programmet på Facebook eller Instagram. Vi har haft en lille smule sådan ro på med produktionen her hen over sommeren. Der har været travlt, og der har været lidt logistiske problemer. Og mens du hører det her, så er jeg faktisk på bryllupsrejse i Thailand. Så der har været sådan lidt forskellige ting. Men FitnessMK lever stadigvæk. Der er også stadigvæk folk, der spørger, hvor man finder de gamle afsnit fra Radio24syv-tiden. Og dem finder man altså på Radio24syv-appen eller på hjemmesiden. De er ikke særlig godt indekseret, så man skal lede en lille smule, men de ligger altså derinde. Og det er lidt lettere at finde dem på mobilappen, end det er at finde dem på desktop. Anywho, vi skal i gang med dagens program. This is today is Wednesday evening, and I'm sitting in my kitchen here in Copenhagen. And I've had the pleasure to catch a guy from Ireland, who's he's a man on a mission. And I'm going to very briefly let you guys that's listening in on the podcast into what this mission is. So my first and true love in life is stuff that's related to physical strength. The sports science that related to strength, the culture that's related to it, the history that's related to it, and what we're going to talk about today touches in on all of these in all of these subjects. And I encountered the today's guest on the podcast just I think maybe a month ago or so,
yeah.
And I immediately it's an amazing project. That I took liking to, so I'm so happy that we got to set up this podcast. So first and foremost, thank you very much, David, for taking your time.
Well, Anders, thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here, man. Thank you for asking me.
Without revealing what the grand project is yet, who are you?
Okay, my name is David Keown, and I am a stone lifter and a stone historian, a strength historian, I suppose you'd call it, from Ireland. I am in the process of looking for these ancient testing stones or lifting stones of Ireland. I've been doing that for the past 2 years, and we'll get into that further in the conversation. But before that, I have a huge history through kettlebell sport. I represented my country for 8 years doing kettlebell sports. So I have a lot of, I suppose, culture for strength over the past decade, you know, which has gradually gone from running, marathon running to kettlebell sport, now into stone lifting and stone research. So that's basically who I am anyway at the start of it.
Have you been involved with powerlifting or classic weightlifting?
No.
No,
not at all. I mean, interestingly enough, I only started doing fitness of any kind at the age of 31. Through my whole 20s, I went to art college and I was into art and music. I play a lot of musical instruments still. I'm playing a band. And that was through my 20s, all that. So I got about to the age of about 30 and I was in a bad place mentally and physically. I was very unfit. I was very unhealthy. I was very unwell. Like I said, both physically and mentally, you know, it was starting to take its toll on me. Late nights, partying, that whole thing through the 20s. You get away with it in your 20s, but my God, when you hit 30, it starts to hit home. So I started just running. I bought a pair of sneakers or trainers, and I ran about 150 yards the very first day. I'll never forget it. And I had to come home because I was so tired and my lungs weren't working properly. But every morning I went out for three months. Oh my God, I was so unfit, so horribly unfit, you know. But to go from there, and 6 months later, I ran my first marathon just through going out every morning, gradually building. And from the marathon, I then went to kettlebell sport and then to this. And what I've done in a decade has just been a revelation to me how you can turn your life around in your 30s, when a lot of, I suppose, people doing like team sports and stuff are kind of coming to the end of their careers. I was only beginning mine at 31. So I always say to people, you're never too old. It's never too late. And you're never too unfit, because I was all of those at 31. And from there to become a world champion, world record holder, and now doing what I'm doing, it just goes to show you that the body will adapt.
So how did the transition from running to kettlebells happen?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because when I was running the marathon, like I had no strength background. I mean, I just went from being this like 110 kilo, this blob of shit sitting on a sofa, 110 kilo, you know, to running. So I had no strength history. So, I mean, when I got to about mile 20 in the marathon, I got a bit of a knee injury. Just because, like, I didn't know weight training or strength training, which you need for any kind of physical sport like this. So, about 3 weeks after the marathon, I was still injured, but I wanted to do something. And I just, through a chance meeting at work, I met a man called Gan Power, who'd be a gym owner, and he had a really cool logo of a kettlebell on his t-shirt. And I was like, "What's that?" And he was like, "It's a kettlebell." And I was like, "What's a kettlebell?" He said, "Come out and I'll show you." So, I know you've a bit of a knee injury. Come out and I'll show you a few kettlebell movements. And we'd done some kettlebell classes. And afterwards, after about maybe 2 or 3 months of kettlebell classes, I saw that he was probably the only man in the southeast of Ireland doing kettlebell sport at that time. So he had a kettlebell sport team, and he was actually on the Irish team. He was competing at the Europeans in 2013.
So that is long cycle, Gyrovic?
Long cycle or biathlon, yeah. So he was doing biathlon. He was doing like a 10-minute jerk and 10-minute snatch. And I just started doing some kettlebell sport, very basic, but just 216s, the novice weights. And I remember doing about 4 or 5 months of that, and doing my first novice competition, a 5-minute competition with 216s, clean and jerk. And what I found fascinating with kettlebells was, you know, anybody can go out and do 10 clean and jerk with kettlebells, no matter what the weight, you know, pretty much. But when you start extending out the time and you start extending out the rep ranges, you know, you really have to concentrate very, very hard on your technique. And
yeah, so you're getting into the 150, 200s.
When you're getting up around 150, 200 reps, or you're getting out the 10-minute sets or longer 30-minute or 60-minute sets, technique becomes everything. So I got fascinated with the minutiae of technique and how to use the least amount of energy possible per rep. And that just led me down the rabbit hole of kettlebell sport, which then took me to the national team and traveling around the world, both competing and teaching it over the past 10 years.
So, here in Denmark as well, the real, like the competitive kettlebell is pretty niche.
Yes,
I guess you could call it. Is that the same thing in Ireland?
It's a little bit bigger in Ireland. I mean, there's two separate kettlebell federations here, and both have, like, you know, a good few hundred athletes in it, you know? It seemed to have taken off. No matter where we went in the world, we always had a fairly big team, you know, one of the biggest teams. So it seemed to suit maybe the psyche of the people here. People maybe just took to it more. But it's fairly popular, you know?
Interesting. How big is CrossFit in Ireland?
CrossFit, I'm not sure, to be honest with you. It's not something I keep track of. I do see CrossFit gyms in every, pretty much every county I go to, you know. I will see a CrossFit gym. So I would say it's relatively big as well. Probably on the same, but maybe a little bit more so than kettlebell sport.
Well, because I don't know the numbers of like by European countries, but in some, we actually have the, back when CrossFit was still a popular brand, we had the world's biggest CrossFit affiliate that has a very big chain of CrossFit gyms that got to a very large degree of market penetration here in Denmark. So I think relatively, we've got CrossFit bigger in Denmark relatively to most other European countries. I'm just thinking maybe that CrossFit has absorbed some of the people that would otherwise have gone into kettlebell sports, because some of the culture and stuff is similar between them.
And the fact that there's kettlebells used in CrossFit as well, isn't there?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Sometimes pretty badly, but they're used.
Well, I just went to the gym and I met a guy that I've trained with, and he used to be an instructor of what is called gymnastics in CrossFit. But he just confided in me that he has come to resent that CrossFit used the terms gymnastics around this, because he's a former gymnast and he thinks that the way it's applied in CrossFit is the bastardization. And I guess to some extent I feel the same way about the way that weightlifting is
implemented in CrossFit. But fuck that. CrossFit is nice in its own right. It's
exactly.
It's just different.
It's just different. We leave it at that. Exactly.
Yeah. So something happened 2 years ago that set you down this path. Can you elaborate on what that is?
Oh, of course. This is where this passion really started. So I started, first of all, I looked at those rogue documentaries. I'm sure most people have seen them. And if you haven't, please do.
Levantadores and Full Stercore and is there a third one as well?
Stoneland from Scotland.
Stoneland.
So I watched those and I just got fascinated by the fact that these stones were not just like stones we picked up. They had cultural merit and they had cultural value, and they were deeply ingrained in the culture of these peoples and these countries.
I cannot recommend these documentaries enough. I actually tried a little bit when I saw the Spanish one.
Oh man. I mean, like I said, it hit, and I'm the same. I mean, it gets you emotional, and I must have seen them at least 10 times each at this stage, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, even if you're not into strength history, if you're not into strength training at all, just a beautiful documentary on culture, on landscape, and on what it means to these people. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful documentary, all three of them, you know?
Yeah.
So, but what I was thinking was, like, there's a Fena stone. The Fena were like the warrior band of old Celtic Irish warriors in Ireland. The Fena, or the Fianna, they were called, you know, a couple of thousand years back. Very, very famous and still talked about to this day. And their leader was Fionn McCool, who was one of the Irish heroes of Irish lore and Irish culture. And I heard there was a Fena stone in Scotland. You know, in the Stoneland, there's a Fena stone in Glen Lyon. So they're saying, like, this was a stone used by the Fena warriors as part of their test to become a warrior. So I was like, are you telling me that there's a Fena stone that Fionn McCool or the Fena were attributed to have picked up, and that's still sitting in a field in Scotland? So that blew my mind. It was like, this is part of our lore. This is part of who we are. So I was like, I have to go see this stone. So I traveled to Scotland specifically to lift that Fena stone and become, you know, get physically in touch with my Irish warrior past or a Celtic warrior.
Do you have a wife?
I do. She's very understanding.
What did she say when you were going to Scotland?
She was like, why in the name of God are you going to Scotland to lift a stone? There's stones all over the place here as well. I said, I know, but like, this is a special stone. She's like, look, I know you're fucking crazy. Just go. You know, she's used to me at this stage. But I went and I lifted that stone and it was just an amazing moment. It was truly incredible. And then it got me thinking, right, there's stones in Scotland, there's stones in Iceland, and we're flanked by these two countries. And we're in the middle, and there's no history of our culture of strength training here, or stone lifting.
Can I stop you for a second?
Sure.
Tell me about the Fena stone. How did it work out when you went there?
Oh, okay.
What did it look like?
It's incredible. It's incredible. So look, to take it back a small bit again, I met a man called Jamie Gorion, who's one of the best natural stone lifters in the world. Scottish man, he took the full day off on Saturday, and we went and we lifted 12 stones on the Saturday, 12 specific rites of passage stones, or Clochnirt, as they're called.
So how close stone, to each other? So you drove around all day?
We drove around the whole of the Southern Highlands. Jamie drove us around in his car. It was an incredible day, Anders, absolutely magic. The weather was fantastic. We drove to all these separate glens, and every glen had its own testing stone, or manhood, or rite of passage stone, or warrior stone. So the last one we went on the day was the Fena stone. So at that stage, I was getting pretty beat up and pretty tired. You know, you're lifting stones from between 100 to maybe 150 kilos.
I've been training for this
about 12 to 16 months.
So how did you go about training for it?
I trained with stones here. I mean, I don't think there's anything better than actually lifting the thing itself. So I'm at the back of four stones at the back that I train with. I will train with them maybe twice a week. And I go out to the beach, about 20 minutes from me. There's just this massive boulder-strewn beach, which is the best natural gym in the world, 20 minutes from me, called Benvoy Beach. And I go out and I train on those stones. I bring out weighing gear, I weigh them. So I train with stones anything from 90 kilos up to 160 kilos. And I use it like a deadlift protocol. I just go out and train on those. So I spent, like I said, 16 months training specifically for this tour.
So do you use it?
Went over to Scotland, had an incredible time.
Workouts with or without Taggy?
Different workers with the stones.
So, stones have different textures and dimensions. And how do you put that into the training?
That's exactly it. So, I mean, what I do is I train with very, very smooth stones out on the beach that have been rolled through the tide. and they're extremely smooth, like polished marble, you know, so you're going out and it really works the grip strength. So they're wonderful to train with, because I always was of the opinion of, even when training with kettlebell sport, like train hard and compete easy, you know. So I'd be training myself at different times of the day. I would wake up and very early in the morning, 4 a.m, go out and start training. And I do the same thing with the stones. It was like lifting the most difficult stones I could find. The smoother the stone, the more difficult it is. I'd lift them in and out of the water, adding again less friction. So I was doing a lot of that kind of training and pushing myself hard with it. So by the time I went to Scotland, lifting stones with chalk and with towels and stuff it felt so easy, you know, compared to the training I was doing at home. So that's the kind of stuff that I've been doing over the past couple of years. So I mean, that really paid off. So I went to Scotland, I lifted the stones I wanted to lift, and then we got to the Fianna Stone. Now, the Fianna Stone is, you drive through this tiny little road, one-lane road through this glen in Scotland, Glen Lyon, which is absolutely beautiful. And the day was gorgeous. It was a really, really bright day. And we pull up to, because I remember seeing it on the Stoneland documentary, we pull up beside the hedge where this stone is, and you see it sitting on its plinth. It's like, it's almost like a rounded pyramid shape stone. It weighs 127 kilos and it's made of a dolerite. So it's pretty dense. It's pretty heavy. It's a bit denser again than granite. So I went out, and at that stage, like I said, I was tired after lifting maybe 11 or 12 other stones, but I went down to put my hand on this stone and you could just feel a tangible energy off it. You know, it's like people have lifted this for over 1500 years.
Just a little bit of magic.
It's magic. It's absolutely magic. I mean, you're like, how many people have put their hands on this in the past, you know, millennia? You know, how many people have lifted it? How many lives have come and gone? How many warriors use this as a part of their rite of passage? Like it just blows your mind. And you're in the same glen that they did. They did that in. So I went down and I rolled the stone out. I asked Jamie, what's the most traditional way to lift it? He said, roll it out the length of your kilt, which is 8 to 10 feet. Pick it up, walk it into the plinth and put it on the plinth. So I did that and it was just an amazing feeling. So I said that started me off on my journey to looking for Irish testing stones, because at that stage I almost felt there had to be something in Ireland, you know?
Yeah. So is it considered cheating using tacky for these stones?
No tacky. You cannot use tacky on natural stones. Not allowed. Very, very bad form. You know, nobody would like you if you'd done that. Chalk, yeah. You chalk away, wipe the chalk off afterwards. Because, I mean, a lot of these stones, I feel they should almost be in a museum. You know, they've so much cultural merit and they've been around for so long that we're very, very lucky to be able to lay hands on these stones. So it's just to be respectful of them. You know, when you're laying them down onto a stone plinth, be very, very gentle. When you're taking them off, be very, very gentle. Because the last thing you want to do is lay it down and maybe hit a stone under the earth and split the stone or break it. Because that happened with one of the stones in Scotland. It happened with the Wallace putting stone, that an American put it up on his shoulder. And instead of laying it down, he threw it down on the ground, hit a stone and split in half. You know, so then that stone is gone. You know, so that can happen. It's a natural object. You think, oh no, sure, it's a stone. But like these kind of things can happen. So it's just to be very, very mindful of these things when you're lifting them, just to be respectful.
Yeah. So you say that weighs 126 kilos?
127 kilos for the Fianna Stone. So it's like I said, it's an awkward shape. Like I said, it's kind of that pyramidal shape. So I found that I stood it up like a pyramid on its base, and I picked it up from the bottom up into my lap, hugged it tight, stood up and walked in the 10 feet, you know?
Yeah. So how much is known about which of these stones are supposed? I mean, if it's for testing, if it's enough to lab it or to chest it or to shoulder it, or
yeah, it was always what they said. The test for that was to put it on its plinth, because there's a man called Peter Martin who will be pretty much responsible for bringing back Scottish stone lifting single handedly. He went off researching pretty much like I'm doing over here. He was my inspiration. And he went researching there about maybe 15 years ago. And he went from there being only two lifting stones in Scotland in 2012, the Inverse Stone and the Dinny Stones, and that was all that was known. He went off and he found over 100 lifting stones, 30 that are still available to lift. And he found references to over 100. But he physically found about 30 or 32 himself. So he's an absolute legend.
So and, he went to confirm physically that their presence and...
He did. For like I said, there was only two. There was just the Inverstone and the Dinny Stones. So he went off pretty much and brought it back himself. So huge respect to Peter. I forget the question now. I'm sorry. I tend to ramble a little bit, but
So I think you started out with how you're supposed to, like the folklore about what is the...
Oh, the folklore. That's right. That's right.
So Peter,
that's exactly it. So Peter wrote that he all in his research that the plinth was there, but it was a higher plinth. So they had to lift
originally.
It. Originally it was higher, but I think it's over the thousands of years, it's sunk further down into the earth, you know? It was maybe about 3 feet high or 4 feet high. Now it's only literally about maybe 16 inches high, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, and the people back then was probably a little shorter than we are now.
Maybe a little bit shorter. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, they probably were anyway, exactly.
So the wind should probably be quite a lot higher.
Yeah, exactly. But that was the Scottish tour, which was incredible. And then the Irish stone lifting research started, which was just, it's been some adventure, Anders, over the past 2 years. It's just been absolutely amazing, you know? Just finding these things. Like, first of all, to find that the culture was there at all, because like when I went on to researching about these, there was no written culture of stone lifting in Ireland, nothing, you know? No library, no nothing. And the thing with Ireland is, though, we're a very oral culture. We always were. And the Celts in general were very oral people. Like, stories came from father to son, word of mouth. So people knew about this thing. People knew about the culture, but it wasn't a written culture. And there's many, many different reasons for that. A, because of our oral nature. B, because of colonization through the British. And trying to get rid of the Irish culture, Irish language, and Irish religion, which happened like over the past 600 to 800 years. So it was almost gone. It was practically gone. There were still men who knew about these stones, but they said there was nothing written. So it was a difficult enough journey to begin with. But we have a fantastic site here called Dukas. And Dukas means, it's Irish for birthright. And it's back in 1937, 38 and 39, the Irish government put folklore and tradition on the curriculum for school children at the age of 12. So they said, go back to your parents and grandparents. All these kids have 11 and 12. Go back to your parents and grandparents and ask them about local folklore. Your area, what happened in your area that was important to culture? Like some whatever, it's local heroes, whether it was fairy stories, whether it was like medicines or old recipes, anything. But every school in the country had that on their curriculum for 3 years, which I thought was just an incredible idea. So all these little kids were running around asking their parents and grandparents, writing down all these stories. All of these stories were collated, sent up to the National Folklore Collection up in UCD, University College Dublin, and they've been sitting there ever since. So, I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of stories sitting in these little handwritten copybooks by these kids, told to them by their parents and grandparents. So I started reading and researching through that. And that's where I started finding these stones and stories. And the more I found, the more I searched, the more I found. And the thing is, they were written by kids. So like, they're written by kids in these local areas. So like, yeah, the kids sitting, who were living in that area, they knew where these things were. So they just say, it's down at the crossroads. There's a stone at the crossroads. Or there's a stone that was thrown over Larry Hyland's wall. You're like, who's Larry Hyland and where's his wall? Or, you know, which crossroads out of maybe 15 crossroads in this area, you know.
So how are the stories indexed?
You can type in keywords into Dukas. You can just type in, so I just type in stone, S-T-O-N-E, and I get maybe 100,000 references to stone in Dukas. So then it's a matter of just painstakingly scanning through each one, and every maybe 100 to 150, there might be a story about a strong man or strong woman who picked up a certain stone in a certain place. And then it was just a matter of just driving to the place and asking the local people, you know.
But could you see which school each story was from?
You can see which school it's in. You can see which school, so you knew generally what area it's in.
Yeah.
You know, so it'd be in a small village. So, like, I've been talking to a lot of professors since then, since I've started doing this, you know. They're like, how did you find these stones? I said, I just went to the village. You know, village people are very, very innately curious people, especially in Ireland. Like, you know what I mean? We're wicked fucking nosy. Like, we love somebody doing something out of the normal. So, I mean, if I go to a village, I might have some kind of a connection. I might go onto Facebook and look up the local village, and they might have an archaeological or historical group, and somebody might get back to you. So I'll go up and I'll meet that person. And they were like, I don't know about it, but go down to Johnny down the road there. He's he's the old farmer living down there, just maybe 200 yards. Go down and knock on his door. You might go down to this guy. He could be 85 or 90 years old. And then you start asking him questions. You're like, oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah. I haven't heard about it in 50 years. I haven't thought about it in a long time, but I'm sure it's still there. And then he'd tell you exactly where to go. So it's usually at a crossroads or a cemetery. And then you just end up driving down to the cemetery and there it is. You know, it's sitting there. Maybe it wasn't touched for 100 years, 150 years, 50 years. You never know, but it's that's that testing stone of the village is just sitting there. But no,
how could you tell that that's the specific lifting stone? If it's 100 years old, it must be overgrown.
A lot of times. Yeah, oh God. A lot of times they are overgrown, but they are, a lot of them in the stories were described, you know, their shape, their size, okay. And generally where they are, you know. So we'll say like somebody threw the lifting stone out over the graveyard wall. So you will go down by the graveyard, look around the outside walls, and all of a sudden you see this huge stone that's totally out of place just because there's nothing else there, you know. And there's like, there's nothing else here. There's a huge stone. It's, they say, might say it's an egg-shaped stone. It's like, there it is. But you had to like, I'm bringing a slash hook with me, and like, you're slashing through briars and hedges. But you, all of a sudden you find this thing, and like, that's the testing stone that has been lifted since. Because, I mean, the stories were from 1937, you know, and they're like, in the story, you could have said, I might have said, the last man to lift it was 50 years ago. So you're going back to like, you know, the 1800s, the last time somebody picked that stone up. But it's just been fascinating. And like, the more I went off and started finding, because it started off just as this innocent journey, just to see, was there something here, Anders? You know what I mean? It was like, is there a culture here? But the more I dug and the more I found, the more I was like, yeah, there is a huge culture of stone lifting here. But it was just suppressed. It was gone. Yeah. You know what I mean? We had the great famine of the 1840s here, where there's a massive emigration, a massive, you know, amount of people died in there, and like half the population died or emigrated in the 1840s. And a lot of that knowledge went with them. It went to America, it went to Europe, you know, it went to the cities or the people who just died off. And the stories were forgotten, the culture was forgotten. And I'm just bringing it back, something that was ours for many, many hundreds, if not thousands of years. I'm bringing these stories back, and it's a huge honor to do it, you know?
Yeah. So you've been in touch with some like academic scholars in history.
Yeah.
Are any of them, they get salaries for doing history. Mm-hmm. Are any of them kind of picking up on it or?
Oh God. I mean, there's a man called, there's a professor up in Dublin. He's a professor up in Ulster University up in the north. Called Dr. Conor Heffernan. And Dr. Conor Heffernan is a professor of sociology and strength history. Mm. And he has written many, many papers on Irish stone lifting and the possibilities of it being a thing, being a culture. I read a lot of his theses online. This is before I even started, or as I was beginning to start, I read a lot of his pieces. So when I found the first one, which I found on Inishmore, I sent him on the pictures and I sent him on the videos of the find and all that. And he was absolutely awestruck. You know, he was so happy. He was like, I cannot believe that you found this lifting stone that I've been talking about for years. I can't believe it. You know, you actually went and found it. I'm sitting in my comfortable library, he said, writing stories, but you're going out and finding the damn things. You know, you've actually went to the place and found them. So he's been a huge support. And there's other historians and archaeologists. Now, historians, like I said, archaeologists, folklorists, poets, people are just jumping on board now. It's garnering this whole cultural identity that started off, like I said, as just a little innocent journey for me. But now it's this whole cultural awakening is happening with it. And people are getting extremely interested in it. I suppose due to the fact, like I said, that to the suppression and the oppression of the last couple of hundred years, that we're bringing something back that's uniquely ours, you know, and seen through like a uniquely Irish lens, not a colonized lens, an Irish lens. So people are really latching on to that, you know, and the fact that it ties in the Icelandic, you know, Scandinavian and Scottish connections, you know, Faroe Islands. It's all now interconnected. There was this whole culture of strength training in all of these areas that was long forgotten, but is now coming back.
Yeah. So how far you how far are you in the project of finding these stones? I mean, are you in? So I guess there's a lot of driving around, and do you still have unsolved leads?
Oh, I do. I do. I to be honest with you, it's just that's all I'm thinking about the last 2 years. You know, I'm driving with the wife mad, to be honest with you, because all I'm doing is like every hour of the day, I'm researching either through Dukas or I'm talking to our historians, our folklorists in the West. Yeah, I mean, there's about three or four leads that I'm following at the moment. I think two of them are definitely there, because like for every one I go to one that is not there, you know, because a lot of these stones were lifted at crossroads. So back in the day, like the people would meet at crossroads. It's just, you'd say, I'll meet you at midday at the crossroads, and people would meet on a Sunday, and then there would be either like stone putting, stone throwing, or lifting heavy stones at the crossroads on a Sunday, just as a way of passing the time, you know. They used to call them the trials of strength. So, but a lot of these crossroads stones, Anders, are gone because the crossroads have been, they were probably just pony and trap, you know, but maybe just mud, and now they're all tarmacked. So like these things were just probably just thrown over hedges or maybe broken up and put into the road. Like I've only found two crossroads stones out of all the stones. There's 26 I found now in Ireland. Two of those are only I found at crossroads, and there's so many stories in Dukas. There could be maybe 100 stories of crossroads stones, but there's only two of them left that I found just through modernization. You know, this happens. But further west I'm going, I find there's more of a veneration for them. There's more respect for them. The more west, yeah. It was up until about 3 weeks ago a uniquely Western Irish culture. From the middle of Ireland west, that's where I was finding the stones. There was nothing in the east.
How come?
I suppose because we'd be more, I was thinking about this myself when I was talking to some historians about it. We'd be more kind of, I suppose, Gaelic going west. We'd have a lot of Norman and Viking roots. Like I'm from Waterford, which is like a old, I think it's old Danish or Norwegian for like Vadrafjord or so. We'd be an old Viking settlement from 1914 down in Waterford. So I think it's kind of more Celtic across this way.
Okay.
And I suppose we're further away from Britain that way as well. So, but yeah, it seems to be more of a Western Irish tradition until about two weeks ago when I found a lifting stone, the very, very first one found up in Northern Ireland, which was really, really exciting because Dukas at the time didn't actually include the six counties in the north as part of their research. You know, they weren't counted. So there's a whole tradition up the north that isn't really that well known by people down in the south. So I found this lifting stone. I was told about this lifting stone up in Tyrone, which is up north in Northern Ireland. And to find that and to know that there was a culture up there as well, it predates Northern and Southern Ireland. It predates that divide. It's a uniquely all-Irish tradition now, you know? So to find that was very, very important. And it's also the stepping stone between the West and Scotland. It's right in the middle, you know? So the Western stones, and then you have this stone in Tyrone, which is right up north, and then you're on to Scotland. So it not only united Ireland, it also united the two Celtic cultures of Ireland and Scotland. So that was a fantastic find.
Do you know if this all this work and this documentation and awareness around these stones has made people go out and lift them, aside from you?
Yeah. Oh, God. I done a podcast, Anders, about 3 weeks ago called the Blind Buy Podcast, which would be the biggest podcast in Ireland, and it would have a huge international draw as well. I didn't know that before I done it. I was kind of a little bit innocent about it, but it seems to be like one in 10 people in Ireland listen to this podcast, I was told afterwards, which is massive.
Yeah.
So when that podcast dropped, I must have got, I would say, probably 3,000 messages a week from people just enamored with the whole idea of it, you know?
Yeah.
They couldn't get over that we had this culture and it was gone, but now it's coming back. And I'd say in the last 3 weeks, I've had about 20, 25 people go out even to look at the stones. They've gone out to hug the stones. They've gone out to take a picture beside the stone. A couple of people have tried to lift them. You know, you're bringing something back, you know, and it's, like I said, it's a huge honor to do it, but it's wonderful because I think you're just blowing on the almost dead embers. And I think this fire will really start to come back now because if this last couple of weeks is nothing to go by, people are very, very interested. I've had guys come from America. I've got guys come from Scotland in the past month to come and lift these stones because they just love the look of them. You know, I had one of the best stone lifters in the world, a man called Sean Urquhart, come over from Ohio. He came over with his dad specifically to lift the Irish lifting stones because he's lifted the Scottish stones, he's lifted the Icelandic stones, he's lifted the Faroe Island stones. And he was just about to go to Sweden, but he said, no, I see what you're doing in Ireland. I got to come there. So now I'm getting contact with all these stone lifters, our strength, our like power lifters. Are you free? Can we come over and lift the stones? Of course you can. You don't have to ask me. You know, I give you the directions. I can meet you if I can, you know. So I'm thinking from next year on, I'm going to organize a couple of dates and do a couple of stone tours every year and say to people, look, I'm off this week. If you want to come, book this week off as well. And we go around Ireland together and we lift these stones together.
That is awesome.
You know, and I tell you the stories and, you know, we go through the whole thing. And Sean was like, the whole experience, he loved it. He was like, it was absolutely incredible. We got, because I mean, the stones are interesting. They're in some amazing places. They're beautiful landscape. I mean, for me as well, like I never went too far west before. Like I'm down the southeast of Ireland, but I've been driving around the west this past couple of years, finding the stones and then meeting the people. And the areas are just the landscape is spectacular. The people are wonderful. So, so welcoming. And the stones are massive. Irish lifting stones are huge. They're, and Sean, who has lifted pretty much every cultural lifting stone in the world, said the Irish lifting stones are the heaviest lifting stones in the world. He said they're the true test for anybody who wants to come and test themselves on lifting stones. Come to Ireland. And I'll say the same thing. Come to Ireland and lift these stones, average 170, 175 kg.
That is really, really big.
It's big for a stone, you know. I mean, and you know yourself, I mean, lifting 175 kg on a bar and lifting 175 kg on a natural, awkward object is a very, very different thing. You know, grip becomes an issue. You have to get down lower with the stone. You're usually lifting it on mud or in sand, you know, or on grass. So you're dealing with the elements as well. It's a fantastic test of strength. And it just looks so cool as well, you know. It's great for pictures, you know. It looks so awesome.
Yeah. So I've actually, I was planning on doing organizing a trip some time back. Then we went to visit some of the lifting stones in Scotland and drink a lot of whiskey. And
that sounds like a plan.
But it seems like you're doing the grand tour instead. So I'll keep people posted and follow your work when it comes.
100%, man. Like I said, anybody who wants to come, I'll organize a couple of dates next year. And I mean, we got plenty of whiskey distilleries in Ireland as well, you know. So I mean, we can really make a really cool week of it.
Yeah. So I mean, how much? I mean, I can probably. I don't have a lot of specific stone training, but I think I can probably lap. I've lapped. I can shoulder a stone of 100, 110. I think
yeah.
I can get a little bit more to the chest, and I don't know how much I could lap, but 170 seems like it would take a lot of very specific training.
Yeah, I mean, I found when I trained for Scotland 2 years ago now, maybe 2.5 years ago, like I was coming from like the whole kettlebell sport background, so I would have a lot of like strength endurance, but not a brute strength. So like I went to Scotland after about maybe 12 months of stone training and lifted most of the stones over there. There were some I couldn't get. But then again, like at that stage, I was only about 80 kilos because I was coming from that endurance background. I was a relatively small size to be lifting those kind of weights. So like the odd Varlik stone, which is 152, I couldn't get that. I could get the wind under it. I could pick it up, but I couldn't get it in my lap. And a couple of the heavier stones, I could get the wind under them, but I couldn't pick them up. I mean, but I would say probably 80% of them, I can get them up to my chest.
Okay.
But I mean, the Irish lifting stones being so heavy, it'd really take definitely a bit of specific training to come and do them, you know? Now, there are some of the stones that are just what we call half lifts. There's about four or five of the stones that it's just to break the ground with them is the valid lift, you know?
Okay.
But those stones would be up and around 190, 207, those kind of weights. So it's literally just to break them off the ground, maybe 1 inch. That's the valid lift. But again, most of them will be to the chest.
Yeah.
So the ones to the chest are, like I said, 170, 150, 60, 70 to the chest takes a bit of specific training.
Yeah. Do you do like conventional resistance training with barbells also, or do you just lift stones?
Honestly, I'm just lifting stones. Like, I'm lifting kettlebells as well. Like, I do a cardio day, maybe one or two cardio days a week, lifting like kettlebell sport for conditioning. But I would do two stone lifting days a week. Okay. One heavier, one lighter. So like, I have a stone at the back that's 90 kilos, but I'm putting kettlebells onto that and using that almost like a deadlift protocol. So building that up now, I'm up around 180, 190 kilos now, pulling from the grass. And I do that once a week. So I'm peaking now because I'm going over to Inishmore Island to lift the Nemo Flaherty stone, which I'll tell you about in a second, which is an incredible story. That's 170 kilos. So I want to get that one up to my chest. So I'm specifically training to get up around 180, 190 here so I can comfortably lift 170 when I go there. Yeah. But yeah, like there's always method. There's always a bit of training involved. And I'm not training in a gym purely because I just love being outdoors. Since COVID, and COVID fucked me up, fucked everybody up. It was very, very difficult over here. Like, we were in a 5K lockdown. It was very, very stringent laws over here. I just got used to training on the beach and I got used to training at the back. And like I said, I have enough equipment at the back. I have my kettlebells, I have my stones, and I have my beach gym, I call it. And you're out in nature. It's fulfilling a spiritual thing for me as well. It's you know, mental health is wonderful. It's not that kind of sterile gym environment. Don't get me wrong. I love training in a gym. I used to train in a gym for 10 years with kettlebell sport, but this is kind of getting something a little bit extra for me as well. Like I said, that more of a spiritual vibe, and to be able to go for a swim and stuff after. So it's just wonderful, you know. So I haven't been back to the gym since, but I mean, I definitely have gotten stronger. And there's really nothing going to beat functional strength, like picking up a heavy object from the ground, you know. So it's definitely got me strong, specifically strong for that purpose.
Yeah, I know. I appreciate that it's totally different things, but what kind of deadlift strength would be like a minimum requirement, do you think, in order to get a stone of 170 kilos? Aside from all the grip and arm length and all that stuff.
Do you know what, Anders? It's really weird because I know guys who can deadlift massive weight, huge weight, massive, like over 250, 300, you know, but they can't lift a stone, you know. Or I know guys who can deadlift small, much like less than 200, but who can lift a stone really, really well, you know. I think it's almost
even 170 kilo stones.
Yeah, because I was talking to Sean, when Sean came over, and he'd be very, very big into to training. This is the guy from America, and he was like, he doesn't do deadlift training at all. He would train in the gym, but he said I would mainly do like cambered box squats and heavy good mornings, and they would really, really help with the pick from the ground, just to have that initial kind of hinge back strength, you know. But I'm just using just the stones themselves to build that up. And using them as a deadlift protocol. But this is coming from the best guy in the world, so I'll take his advice, you know. So he said, like, deadlift and stone lift, well, they look similar. They are different enough that I think the likes of a good morning or a box squat would actually be more beneficial. Now, I mean, I went in and I just, for the first time to a gym, I think about 12 months ago, I'd never trained deadlift and I pulled 220 easy. I didn't want to push myself, but like, I'd never lifted a deadlift since training for kettlebell sport, and I was only like lifting 100 kilos for maybe sets of 20 because of strength and endurance. But I went in and pulled 220 easy, and I was like, I know I could push that more, but I don't need to, you know. So like, it did build a lot of strength in me.
Oh no.
For basic lifts, for the basic gym lifts as well, you know.
Yeah. But I'm just asking. I know that a lot of people would ask if I didn't. So I would be thinking about it if I didn't. So, I mean,
of course, but I mean, like, it's not going to do you any harm. Ain't nothing wrong with getting strong, you know. Oh, I mean, no. Jesus, deadlift, squat, do your basic lifts. But I mean, if you wanted to get like a specific gym work for stone lifting, I would say box squats, any kind of squats, and heavy good mornings, you know, they're going to be your best friend for stone lifting.
Yeah.
Or just go lift some damn stones.
I mean, a nice example of the poor correspondence between deadlift strength and stone performance would be the modern strongman Mateusz Kiliskowski, that is not a very good deadlifter by strongman standards, but is incredible talent for stones.
My God, I think he has the heaviest stone to shoulder of all time. I think with that 220 natural stone, he's
damn.
His stone lifting is absolutely unbelievable, and like you said, his deadlifting wouldn't be great. And then like, it was mad when I'm watching that and like. There's guys pulling up around 450 kilos in a deadlift. But I was watching like at the Arnold lifting the Bill Odden tombstone, which is 186 kilos. And a lot of them couldn't even break the ground with it. So there you go. You know, these guys are pulling almost triple that.
So what do you think
in a deadlift? You know, it's they're almost triple. I mean, definitely 2.5 times what the stone weighs, but they can't pick it up. Because I think you're bent forward further, way much further than you are in a deadlift. And the grip strength specifically becomes a huge issue, you know? Yeah. So like I've been training grip strength a lot. Again, like through years of kettlebell sport, I did anyway. I did a lot of gymnastic rings work as well over those 10 years. So definitely the grip was never an issue with me. It was just the strength was the issue. So I just had to build the strength up over the past couple of years. Of course, specifically for the Irish stones, which are absolutely massive. I mean, I remember finding the force and was like, Jesus, this is huge. It's 170 kilos. We weighed it. Like, my God, that's so heavy. You know, the heaviest mainland Scottish lifting stone is 160. And like there's 32 of them. I was like, wow, you know, this huge stone. But every stone I found after that was like 165, you know, 155, 180, 185, 192, 200, 207, 230. It's like, what were these Irish guys eating back in the day? You know what I mean? They were absolutely incredibly strong, you know, but with the Scottish stones, they were rites of passage stones. So like there were stones, a lot of them, maybe 60, 70% of them were stones for like youths to become a man, was to lift the stone. So you can't have that like 170 kilos.
At least a significant proportion of people should be able to lift it at some point in their life.
Exactly. Yeah. Where, and then the Icelandic stones you're up against like the strongest men in the area. You'd have the half Sturkar and the full Sturkar stones, you know. They'd be the strongest fishermen and farmers in the area. Whereas I find with the Irish stones is it's the strongest man in the area lifted his stone as a feat of strength. Maybe 60% of the Irish stones are feats of strength stones or legend stones. There is some rites of passage stones as well, but a lot of them you're testing yourself against the strongest man. And it's a very humbling thing, Anders. You're testing yourself against the strongest man of maybe 200 years ago or 150 years ago who had no specific strength training. He had no nutrition training. He didn't know what he was eating. He was probably just eating potatoes and buttermilk. And he could go out and lift this stone. And you're like, you're struggling to do it with periodized strength training and proper nutrition. You know, it's a humbling thing, but it's good to be humble sometimes.
Yeah. Last training question. Did you do any specific grip stuff like Rolling Thunder or something like that?
Because when you're lifting stones, specifically with that stone I'm training with out in Benvoy Beach, it's like lifting up polished glass. You know? It's been rolled through the sand for millennia and it's just circular and smooth. So that grip training and that, I come out of there and sometimes I can barely move my hands because it's just, you're working your forearms so much with just trying to get a grip on this thing. You don't need any other specific grip training. Definitely not.
So is the forearms the limiting factor when you go to lift these stones?
I would say a lot of people, I mean, I've seen strong men way bigger and way stronger looking than me who cannot pick up these stones. I had a man, the guy who owned the gym actually, Gan, came out with me one day. And I was lifting one of the smaller stones, 115 kilo. But again, a small stone can be deceptive. If it's smooth, it can be very, very difficult to pick up. I was picking this stone up for part of training, sets of 8. And I went over and said, try that stone. And he couldn't even flip it over. You know, this guy could do like up around 200 kilo deadlift, but he couldn't even flip the stone over, you know, because it was so smooth. So it's like it's kind of what I call farmer strength or functional strength against gym strength, and sometimes there can be
that strength.
It's a different strength, dad strength, old man strength, exactly. Getting old now, hitting the mid-40s, but I'm just going to keep going as long as I can.
I went to back where I did my PhD. We used to have a testing center for the Danish called Team Denmark, the Danish. Like organization that supports, like a government-funded organization that supports elite sports in Denmark.
Yes.
And I was there with some weightlifters that was there for, like Olympic weightlifters that were there for testing and like guys that were squatting and deadlifting in excess of 200, one of them even squatted 300 kilos in the zone. And
wow.
Very strong guys. And their coach was there and he used to be a weightlifter himself, but he's like a, he's got more of an office dead bot type now.
Yeah, yeah.
And we did grip testing And despite both of these young guys being like significantly stronger in weightlifting than any of us, we outperformed them by 50% or something like that in grip strength, even without specific training. So I think there is something about the whole dad.
There certainly is. There is. I mean, there you go. I mean, these guys can pick up a bar. But like I said, bars are meant to be lifted. You know, that's what I always say. Bars are made to be lifted. Stones aren't. So you got to get strong enough to lift it, you know? And sometimes the limiting factor is, can you get a grip on the damn thing?
Yeah.
Because if you can't grip it, you're not going to be able to lift it up, no matter how strong you are. So
You ever used cast concrete stones to get like the proper shapes or sizes you need for gradual exposure and training?
No, I never had. I mean, I would use an Atlas stone if I had them. I don't use Atlas stones. We're lucky, like where I am on the beach. Like I said, like I'm out there once a week, and there could be 500 massive stones out there that I can pick from at any given time. You know,
you can always find something of the right
size. There's always something I need. There's always something I need. I'm just lucky, you know, and people have said to me, you're so lucky where you live. I'm living right beside the sea.
And maybe the stones are finding you rather than
I think maybe, that's actually a nice way of putting it. I think they might be. Because this beach I go to, there's never anybody there. It's a little hidden cove. It's only about 100 meters long. And it's like my own personal gym, you know, it's wonderful.
Nice. So obviously you already like touched in on this briefly. You've been in touch with people doing similar stuff in other countries.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of people know about the stones in Iceland. Mm-hmm. And at least I think the Danish stones is probably the most famous Scottish stones.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It was one of the most famous in the world, I suppose, really. Yeah.
And in Denmark, it's pretty shitty. I've only heard of one so far.
I mean, I can guarantee you there has to be more. You know, I mean, like there has to be more because there's so many. I got in contact with a friend of mine in Norway, and there's about four or five stones that I could go researching for up there. I think physically there's three or four there anyway. But Sweden. Friend of mine sent me on all his information from, I think we touched on this the last time we had a chat. Like he has about 150 stones in Sweden. And there's definitely about 70 that are there and being mapped and you can go visit them. You know, Sweden is absolutely full chock-a-block of lifting stones.
Yeah.
So if Sweden has such a huge, huge culture and history of lifting stones, and not, it's also in Norway, has to be loads in Denmark. I can't see why there couldn't be. You're being so close.
I think one of the problems in Denmark would be finding ones in Ireland. I think what could make it more difficult in Denmark is that Denmark is one of the most agriculturally developed, for lack of better word worse word, in Europe. And I think so. When like. Large areas is made into like farmland. They're moving the fences and the
Then that's where they get lost, you know. And I think that's what happened in the east of Ireland as well, because there's many, many stories in the Dukas archives about stones all of the eastern side as well. But because it's a more highly developed area and being closer to Dublin, that's where the stones get lost. And the land is so much rougher and craggier, and you can't actually put any agriculture over in the likes of Galway, Clare, these places on the west, because it's just rock, it's just stone. You can't do anything with it, you know, that these stories and these stones stayed there and were left alone.
I suspect that's the case with, I suspect that's the reason they could find so many stones in Sweden as well, because they have the same thing, like large, craggy, rocky areas that can't be made into farmland.
That weren't disturbed, you know. So it's a shame. They could be lost, but I mean, it'd be lovely to find a few there, you know. It'd be lovely to connect with your past, you know. That's what I find with these. You're connecting with your ancestral people, you know, and you're testing yourselves against these men, and it's a lovely feeling. It's part ritual, I think, and part strength training. That's what I love about stone lifting, you know. And you're reaching back through the past and you're grabbing onto these people kind of through the stone. It's kind of beautiful, you know?
Yeah. I'm certainly going to start looking for older Danish stones if I can find anyone except for the one. But
yeah, I mean, definitely do it, because I mean, like, again, the Faroe Islands has a huge culture of it as well. That was almost lost. Sean Urquhart again done a lot of research on that and found about maybe 30 stones on that small nation. You know, the Faroe Islands, again, huge stones, massive stones, testing stones for farmers. To see how strong they were, whatever stone you could lift, you would get more of a share, or you in the you do harder work, but you get more money. And it's like the ones in Iceland with the Drifvik stones. Whatever stone you lifted, you got better share of the catch as a fisherman, you know. And in Sweden, a lot of the tests were, again, if you could lift this stone, you got this much money. So your strength was your worth, was how much you could bring home to your family. So. It's very, very interesting that, especially in Sweden, a lot of the stones were for that reason, for farmhands.
Yeah. So the people that you're getting in touch with that are interested in this stuff, are most of these people that have like strongman sports affiliations or interest, or is it mostly like from interest in local folklore and myth?
All local folklore. It's all local knowledge. Nobody through weightlifting. It's all through old people and old stories. So I go up to say West Galway, and I meet with a local folklorist and a poet, a man called Sean O'Kirstalva. And Sean is known throughout all of Ireland. He's kind of a cult icon, and he knows pretty much everybody in the west of Ireland, and everybody knows Sean. But he knows all the old men. You know, so all the old men would meet up, and the old fishermen and the old farmers, and he would know all them and ask them stories. And they would be like, yeah, there was a testing stone down there, down by the harbour, that the men used to lift when they came in from the boats, from collecting seaweed or out fishing. They would then have tests of strength to see who was the strongest. And that stone is still there. And then he'd ring you up, David, there's a stone in Carna in West Galway called Clochnarkeen, or called Clochcailleganishge. And I have the man who knows about it. He's going to meet us. Let's go up and see it. So then I drive to Galway, which is like a 5-hour drive from me, and I'd meet Sean. And then I meet this old man who would have all the knowledge of this stone, the men who lifted it. He's like, my great granddad was the last man to lift that stone back in the 1920s. And he will have all the tales about it. And he'd be like, there it is there. And then you go and you lift it up, and you're the first person to lift it up in 100 years, and you're bringing the culture back. And that's one. Then I went out to one called Clochnarkeen, which was out in Lettermore, again, far out in West Galway, up at the coastline. And again, it was a fisherman stone, and it was a testing stone in an old natural wharf. And Arkeen is an old wharf or a cove. So Clochnarkeen, stone of the cove. And you go out, and the man who lived, the last man to lift the stone, would be living up 200 yards away from the stone. And all the way along the wall, there'd be like weeds and flowers. And this guy would be after cutting away all the flowers and weeds where the stone is. Because, you know, he still has the veneration and respect for it, because he's the last man to lift it like 60 years ago. And he said, I come down here every 3 weeks and I cut away all this weeds so that stone is still there. People can still see it. Because he said, I remember how well that made me feel, you know, and the respect I got in my village. So then I go up to lift it, right? So I'm coming and I said, I'd like to try and lift it. He's then on the phone telling all his friends, there's a man here come to lift the stone. He's come to lift the stone. So then there's men coming from across the fields. There's men coming from everywhere. Wait, and he said, wait half an hour. And all these men just start coming from across the fields. And then you see all the wives come out with flasks of tea.
The pressure is on.
And the children come out running around, and the dogs come out running around. And all of a sudden, there's like 50 people there, you know, standing around you. And they're all talking, because everybody speaks fluent Gaelic. They're all speaking Irish. And they're all talking about the last man who lifted a Mihal and like how wonderful thing it was. And I guess then the pressure is on, because you're like, oh, shit. And I'm looking at the stone. It's like the Clochnarkeen is 191 kilos.
You know, ouch.
It's absolutely massive. But the valid lift was just to get it off the ground an inch.
Okay.
So after about 5 attempts, because it's a really unusually shaped stone, it's almost like a whale's back. It comes up and then down, it tapers down. And it's narrow, but the center of balance is awkward. It's only about 1 mil either way. If you lift it too far up one end, you're only going to lift one end.
So
you have to straddle it. Yeah. And put your hands underneath it and just lift it off the ground, you know? So after 5 attempts, it took me 5 attempts under serious pressure. I was going to actually give up, but I said, no, do it one more time. You nearly had it, because I was too far forward the first time, too far backwards. Then I was starting to get tired. I said, give it a minute. So I went out and they're all cheering. And then I got the lift and they're all up the whole place up hogging you, you know, everyone over hugs and handshakes and maham far, maham bukal, like, well done, you know, fantastic. And everyone taking photographs and the kids are calling you Superman. You know what I mean? It's just, you've become part of the local lore. You've become part of this local place. And they're so proud that you've come up to do this. You know, they're so proud that you're coming up 5.5 hours off just to lift this stone and become part of their local lore. So it's wonderful. I mean, it's an absolutely wonderful thing to do. And now that I'm putting this on the map, and I've map pinned all these, and there's GPS locations for all of them, people can come and do it now as well. And it's not just me, but, you know, anybody can come and try it and become part of local history. Just become another link in the chain of that stone.
So, I mean, I don't know what it's like in Ireland, of course, but I think in many ways the time is ripe for this kind of stuff.
I think so.
Because I mean, I think a lot of people, and probably more so men than women, are feeling a loss of identity and culture and all that stuff, and it's. And I think we see the resurgence of like new conservatism, which I have a troubled relationship with.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
For a number of reasons. But I think this is a nice thing because it's beautiful because you can connect with it, and it doesn't have to be related to all that politics stuff.
Exactly. It predates all of that shit. It predates all of that. You know, this isn't like a super nationalist thing of what it's like to be Irish. This is part of our culture. This is part of who we are as a people, you know, and it's cross border. It's all of Ireland. It's not just in this place. It's Celtic. It's Scottish. It's Irish, but it's not, it's further than Celtic. It's this whole bracket, you know, in this whole hemisphere of lifting. It's all interconnected and it's so root and branch. It's so primal. And like I said, it's hitting at the right time because in this weird, like, postmodernist world that we're in, where everything is refuting everything else online, anything you look up online, you can have a scientific paper say it's good or it's bad, everything. And people are confused out there, and rightly so, of course they are, you know. And things are getting a bit more homogenous, you know, like we're losing a lot of our culture. And like, you know, like I said, I'm not fiercely cultural or national. It's like, your culture is very important to who you are as a person. You know, once you lose your roots, you kind of lose, you're kind of flapping free. You kind of don't know who you are. So I think to get in contact with this unique piece of history, you know, and you're not just reading about it, Andrew, you're picking it up. You're putting your hands on it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. You know, you're getting physically in touch with your past, you know. And no matter where you are in the world, there's a culture of stone lifting. Because, I mean, I'm reading up about it in everywhere. Pakistan, India, Japan.
Japan,
you know, huge. I mean, over in Hawaii, over in the Polynesian Islands, there's huge.
Some African lifting stones as
African,
well.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the oldest form of strength training in the world. So it's wonderful, like, to be getting, in, like I said, physically in touch with your ancestral past. And like I said, I think in this weird kind of postmodernist world that we're in, it's lovely to be doing that.
Yeah. Stones don't lie.
They don't. They lie where they are. And it's up to you to see, are you strong enough to pick them up?
Yeah. Some more gravity to fight, I guess. So how do you document the work that you do here with the stones?
So I'm actually in the process of writing a book at the moment on it, which I'm really enjoying. It's more like a diary on what I've been doing and the people I've been meeting and the stories and the stones and everything like that. So it's also all up on my Instagram. I'm going to go onto my Instagram page. I'm doing as Indiana Stones. So just type in Indiana Stones. You'll get all of my stories.
A nice pun with the name, by the way.
Exactly. I like that one. Someone called me that a couple of months ago. I was like, no, I like that. So so I have it online. There's just a load of documentaries being made now. It's amazing what's happened in the past 6 weeks, and it really is. Like I've three separate filmmakers now looking to make films about this, and one from the BBC, one from RTE, and an independent filmmaker. I'm on next month's GQ magazine, international magazine, so that's fantastic. And there's all kinds of podcasts, like being on here, you know, it's just all kinds of podcasts happening. And like I said, I'm writing the book, so it's the resurgence is real. It's really, really starting to take off. And I think once all these documentaries and podcasts and the book and all that drops, I think it's Irish stone lifting is going to be, it's going to be big. It's going to be rivaling the likes of the Scottish and Icelandic for tourism and all of that. So it's just wonderful. You know, it's wonderful. And like I said, I'm still kind of pinching myself. I'm like, it's just gone from me in a car driving around with a billhook hacking through hedges to all of a sudden European on international magazines and podcasts, and you're getting people from wanting to make films with you, you know. So it's just been incredible. But like I said, I think it's just hit at the right time. It's got that cultural hook. I mean, archaeologists love it, folklorists love it, professors, poets, strong men. It's ticking a lot of boxes, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
and that's great for that.
So, but you're not compiling it on a website yet, at least.
I'm in the process of it. Myself and Stevie Shanks. I think you remember Stevie from the Stoneland documentary. His dad, Jack Shanks, will be the first mentor to take stones in modern times. Myself and Stevie are compiling a website.
Lost a little bit. Just on, again, I just try that again
for the stones and all that. So we're in the process of doing that. It might take a couple of months, but that should be live hopefully by probably September, October. But in the meantime, you can just go on to the Old Man of the Stones website. And there's about 8 of the lifting stones are documented on that. I think I've lost you there, Anders.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me? Hello?
Ja, som det er med smarte tekniske løsninger, så er de ikke altid smarte nok, og så er der problemer. Så vi har fik lidt klumper i den digitale sovs her, som vi lige skulle bruge lidt tid på at redde ud. Men vi fik redt dem ud, og interviewet det kunne heldigvis fortsætte. I'm not going to complain. I just think it's amazing that you can talk in real time to people hundreds or thousands.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible.
so I can remember exactly where we got cut off.
I
think it was maybe talking about how you were documenting the stuff and if you were
documenting. That was it. That was it. Yes, you're just saying. Look, I mean, there's lots of stuff going on. If people want to look at the stones, they can go onto the Old Man of the Stones website. Which is awesome. And all the stones, the documented lifting stones in the world are on that site. So if you want to plan a tour for anywhere, for the United States, for Scotland, for Faroe Islands, for Ireland, for anywhere, all the stones are on that website. So go on and have a look at those.
So they're indexed with weight and
there should be
and Google Maps.
Weight, you've got the weight, you got the GPS coordinates, you got the pin drops, they're all there, you know. But like I said, I'm going to specifically make one for Ireland soon, because it's only about maybe a third of the Irish lifting stones are on that, because the moderator or the mediator, the person who runs the site, he's just a very busy man. So it's hard to get all of them up, you know. So I'll just do my own over the next couple of months.
Excellent. Excellent. It's I'm going to follow the work onwards.
yeah, man. It's a modern day adventure story. You know, it's incredible. Like, this stuff doesn't happen, you know. This just doesn't happen. I mean, it's not every day you can say you're pretty much single-handedly bringing back an almost dead culture, you know. It's just an absolute honor, and it's a blast, you know. I mean, the buzz you get from doing it, you know, it's incredible. You're leaving early in the morning and you're going to look at these old graveyards or cemeteries, and it's absolutely wonderful. You know, you're driving to this place and then you're like, okay, it might be here, and you're cut through hedges, and then you get the buzz of actually finding the thing. You can't believe it. Like, there it is. It's been sitting there. It might be covered in vegetation for the past 100 years. And you're physically and metaphorically unearthing the thing. You're taking it out of the earth, but you're taking it out of obscurity as well. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine.
It's just wonderful, you know. So like I said, it's still happening now. It's happening in real time. It's happening next weekend. It's, you know, it's still happening. So it's just incredible. So like anybody, just follow along, give me a shout. And if anybody hears of anything, I know we're primarily Denmark here, but even if you hear anything in your own country, people just let me know, because this kind of thing is just, it gives me a great buzz, you know. It's great fun.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's an amazing project, and I for one at least is going to keep on following the project.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for taking your time to talk to me and to the listeners.
My genuine pleasure. Absolute pleasure. And thank you so much for having me on. I'm a real honor. So I love talking about this stuff. As you can tell, it shut me up as the problem. And it's just wonderful to be doing it. And it's wonderful for people to be through podcasting this, to be hearing the stories and hearing about it. So again, thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah. I'm the one thanking, but I have a feeling that we'll be keeping in touch somehow.
Definitely. And like I said, if you ever want to come over and hit me up, I'll take a few days off and we'll go find these things together.
I just might. But I think I will require some more specific stone lifting training.
Yeah. For that. And then you're more than welcome at any stage, man. Come on over.
Thank you very much.
No bother.
Thank you very, very much. It was a pleasure talking to you and contributing with your knowledge and your experience with this project to the podcast and to the listeners.
My pleasure, Anders. Thank you so much again for having me here, man.
Have a beautiful evening. Og det var David Keehan fra Irland, som fortalte sin vilde historie om det her med at løfte sten. Og altså som det fremgår i interviewet, så undrer det mig svært igennem interviewet, at der ikke er flere dokumenterede løftesten i Danmark. Jeg har kun kunne finde en, der ligger på et museum nord for København. Og som vi snakker lidt om i podcasten, så kan en af grundene kan være, at de måske er forsvundet på grund af opdyrkning af landet. I Irland er det den mest vestlige del, hvor løftestenen er. Jeg kunne godt forestille mig, at det samme del var gældende for Danmark, fordi det er den del, der sidst er blevet opdyrket, og hvor der er mest af det oprindelige sådan land tilbage. Hvis du sidder derude og synes, det her det er spændende, så vil jeg gerne bede dig om en tjeneste. Det er at spørge dine forældre eller dine bedste forældre, om de kender til nogle historier om danske løftesten, fordi jeg kunne faktisk godt tænke mig at tage det på mig, og begynde at finde ud af, om der findes flere danske løftesten. Fordi at jeg tænker, at det egentlig også er en del af den danske kultur, når det nu er til stede både i Sverige og Norge, og ja, Færøerne, Island, Finland. For jeg tror, det er derude. Jeg tror bare, det spørgsmål får støvet dem op. Så det kunne være et rigtig nice projekt. Så det håber jeg, I vil være med til at bakke op om. Så det var det. Du har lyttet til Fitness MK. Jeg hedder Anders Nedergaard. Du kan lytte med til den her og de andre episoder af Fitness MK på stream og podcast. Du kan streame dem fra andersnedergaard.dk eller fra Spreaker. Det passer ikke. Det er ikke Spreaker, det er Omni. Og du kan podcasten for alle de store podcasttjenester. Programmet er produceret af Jonas Pedersen, og I skal velkommen til at skrive ind til programmet. Og det er altså stadigvæk afn@andersnedergaard.dk eller på vores Facebook-side eller Instagram-side, der begge to også hedder Fitness MK. Tak for i dag.